So this morning I'm going to give the first of a couple of talks, two talks that I'm going to give on deepening and strengthening meditation. This is based on the assumption that you all have been trying or have some kind of a meditation practice. If not, you should be upstairs. You can do that series as many times as you want. So this is based on the assumption that's intro to meditation for anybody who doesn't know it. And, you know, we suggest people go as many as four times to it because there are four different teachers. So what about those of us, who have been practicing for a while, 6 months or 40 years, and we want to strengthen and deepen our meditation? So today I'm going to talk about classical Buddhist meditation a little bit, the two components from the seventh and eightfold path, and then the next talk I'm going to give, which will be 2 weeks from now, I'm going to give it on Saturday during the retreat, and then I'm going to give it again on Sunday. Will be on kind of issues that people have brought to me and brought to themselves during the last 15 years that come up when they try to strengthen and deepen and how to kind of deal with them. As well as next time I'll talk more about the outcome. There, even though we say no expectation, we all have an expectation. And if we do this in a devoted way, we expect it to get an outcome. But I'm not talking about that today. Okay, so first of all, we've got a little meditation practice going, or a big meditation practice going for a month or for 40 years. And what do we, and, you know, we want to strengthen and deepen it because it's getting kind of stale, or we're having trouble keeping it going, or things come up. So here's just starting off with a couple tips. First tip is remind ourselves of our aspiration. Remind ourselves, hi, come on in. You can sit on a cushion right there or right there. Remind ourselves that meditation is a way to feel more alive and more joyful, to be more in our moments, really, really wholly participating in them. Just remind yourself when you get in a funk or when you have too much to do that actually you'll have less to do if you're doing this meditation because you'll have less inside. Remind yourself. So my youngest grandson, Logan, when just before he turned four, he had an aspiration to kick the ball. and he wasn't allowed to kick it in the house for some odd reason. You guys can sit back there or come on in here if you want. There's a cushion here and there's some chairs out there. Two cushions here. So that was his aspiration. Now, where did that come from? I mean, he does live in France, so maybe it's soccer, but I don't think his dad wasn't interested in soccer. He just had this aspiration. And so every day, Grandpa, kick ball. Grandpa, kick ball. So I go out with him. It was fun. Way to connect with him. Kick ball. Not quite four. Four, his arms and legs don't work. I mean, they're not coming together. So he's missing the ball three quarters of the time. And it's kind of hilarious to watch, actually. But I mean, I love him, so I'm not going to laugh. I just love him. They don't work. Sometimes our meditation doesn't work. It doesn't work. Now, his didn't work in the beginning, but I'm assuming you've got a meditation going already. But maybe it's not working. Your arms and legs, your breath, and your body, and your mind, and your heart aren't in sync. It's not working. So what do? You do it more. You do it more. You come back to what's in your heart here, your aspiration. to live a little more calmly, to live a little more joyfully, to look, feel a little more connection with people. You come back to that aspiration. It's where you started in the first place, wasn't it? You can find that aspiration. You can find your heart. And then what happens after a while? After a while, well, let's see. Logan, he's turned 7. Now he's kicking the ball naturally. And he's still calling me out to play with him all the time, but now I'm falling all over. He's running between my legs. And I'm thinking, I wonder how long I can keep this up, right? But we do it. It comes natural. It comes natural. And we get some, and there's some pleasure. It's not pleasure we cling to. It's just the pleasure of doing, the pleasure of engaging, the pleasure of being with. Pleasure. So our repeated behavior leads to the ability to give ourselves to our meditation and to our life, and to have a little more enthusiasm for whatever is happening. A little more enthusiasm for whatever is happening. So that's the first tip of mine for this morning. Remind yourself of your aspiration. Come back to your aspiration. Number two, set a modest goal. Set a modest goal. Don't be gung-ho about this. You know, you were sitting 10 minutes a day for a couple times a week. Well, try to 3 times a week, maybe 15 minutes a day. A modest goal. Don't get all gung-ho about this. If you get gung-ho, you'll just flip out. It won't work. Just set a modest goal. Turtle practice, a modest goal. A modest goal. Third, and I say this all the time, as my teacher said to me, don't judge your progress. If Logan had judged his progress between the ages he was 4 and 7, he'd still be stumbling around out there with a ball. Instead, he's coming to visit me in 2 weeks, and I understand he's going to wear all his soccer shirts the whole time he's here. Nothing but soccer shirts. He wears them to bed. He wears them to camp. He wears his soccer shirts. Well, that's another thing, but I mean, he has participated in this and learned that he loved it, learned that he can give himself to it. As we know how to do, but only in a limited way. And through our zazen, we're learning to do this in a limitless way, you guys. Limitless. Because we're not caught by our thinking. So the next one is potential distractions. Oh, don't judge progress. Well, don't judge your progress and work with someone. They can help. Work with a mentor. Work with a teacher. We have a lot of teachers here. You can work with one of the other teachers or with me. Come see us regularly. We're pretty nice. We're pretty simple. We can help you with. If you think I'm meeting with Tim, then you don't have to judge your progress. You don't have to think about it. Right. So what about our potential distractions? Seems like we have more potential distractions every year in our culture. So what do we do? Well, you can pay attention to the categories of your distractions. Are you distracted about work? Something? Are you distracted about your partner bitching and moaning about your behavior? Are you distracted about things you didn't do, other worries, other concerns? You can write these down before you start meditating. You can write them down. You can write them down once a week. Write them down. Then you can keep them by your meditation cushion and not think about them, but knowing that you, or not keep them by your meditation cushion. If that's going to make you think about them, don't put them in the drawer. Write them down. Keep a meditation diary. Meditation diary is very simple. All you're doing in this sense is writing down the distractions and just putting them away. And you look at them again, change them, write them down, put them away. It helps you psychologically with your meditation. Not all of you in all cases, but it helps. So the two legs of Buddhist meditation from the path are concentration and bare awareness. And I talked about this briefly a couple of weeks ago, and I have talked about this other times. But I'm going to go into it in a little more detail today. Concentration and bare awareness. And I'm using the term, as I said before, bare awareness rather than mindfulness. And I've always used the term bare awareness rather than mindfulness. The Sanskrit word is smriti, the Pali word is sati. And it can be translated just as easily as bare awareness as mindfulness. I don't use mindfulness because I don't think mindfulness is very descriptive. Bare awareness is more descriptive. This is what we're doing. We're just paying attention, just being aware. And second, because mindfulness signifies just the mind, this is heartfulness as much as mindfulness. It's opening up our heart. It's mind-heartfulness. And the third reason I don't do it is that that people think of mindfulness as being able to remember things. I can't remember anything, and I never could. I can't remember if I put my umbrella in the third floor or the first floor or the basement, or even if I brought an umbrella when it's a rainy day. So I can't teach mine. Not good to teach what you can't know when you don't know. Now that said, we do use the term here. And I'm actually going to be teaching with Wanda next week, mindfulness for mental health professionals. But I'm really teaching bare awareness because I can't do mindfulness. Okay. Billy, if you think mindfulness is being memory, that is, which I don't. Bare awareness is not about memory. It won't necessarily improve your memory. I don't think it will worsen your memory. It won't necessarily improve it. So concentration by itself, we need to do anything. Think about it. Everything we accomplish is based on concentration. It's how we get productive. If we know how to concentrate, we can accomplish a lot in a short period of time. And it can be calming, too. We concentrate, we're just calming on this, just concentrating on this, on the ball, playing with my grandson. Okay. He gets calmed down, I get calmed down. Once he passes that awkward stage, it's not good enough in itself. It's an important factor of meditation. It's not good in and of itself, by itself, because it can be cut off. We could be narcissistic meditators if we just do the concentration. We can become, you know who, the politician meditators. I won't say who. If we're just focusing on this one activity and not paying attention to the pain around it, to what's going on around it, to people's, it's got to be heartfelt. It's got to be open. So 15 years ago, I read the book. I don't remember the name of a book about Bill Mason, the master jewel thief, maybe 20 years ago. Bill Mason, the master jewel thief, was an expert at concentration. And he actually, over the years, he was jailed a few times, but over the years, he stole $35 million worth of jewels over a 25-year career. And he did it through concentration. And he was especially good when he was outside walking on ledges. And here he is. He said, 18-inch ledges between the balconies with nothing to hold on to amidst the storm and the rain were nothing for me. I just concentrated. I let go of everything. I let go of the height. I let go of anything except the being on the whatever it is, the gutter, just being on the gutter. So that's wonderful that we can do that, but that's not obviously enough. So there are two wings to our meditation then, successful meditation, so that we can be more alive, so that we can be more engaged. The narrowing from the concentration meditation and the broadening through the bare awareness. Both of them help us calm down this mind that's always revved up, so revved up. The narrowing and the broadening. Both of us help. So why is it so difficult to strengthen and deepen these? Well, for one thing, it's the incessant thought that we have that something should be happening. I should be better. That's it. That's the whole deal. It's a mandate that we bring to the cushion. And that mandate can only be reduced when we move this mind judgment, this judging, to a soft, our heart opening. Here's our heart. That's why I don't say mindfulness. I say heart mindfulness. Our heart. And a woman named Stephanie Hart, and that's H-A-R-T rather than H-E-E-R-T, says, a good meditation is one you did. The only bad meditation is one you didn't do. Okay? That's the whole deal. A good meditation is one you did. The only bad meditation is one you didn't do. So without the mandates, you can put down the mandates for 15 minutes. I know you can. Or for 30 minutes. Or if you join me on retreat for a whole day or two whole days, but you won't be able to. The mandates will be coming back. That's okay. You can be kind to them. You can open up your heart to them. So Ananda, Buddha's main man, said, noble friends and companions are the whole of the holy life. So we let our friends and companions help us. And we work with a mentor or a teacher just to help us with this, So concentration meditation, two Sanskrit words. One is samadhi. Everybody probably knows the term samadhi. Raise your hand if you know the term samadhi. Half of people. Samadhi. Well, samadhi just means being in the zone. That's what samadhi is, being in the zone. Bill Mason was in the zone when he was doing that, robbing all those people. Being in the zone. That's so wonderful. It's wonderful that we can learn to do that. And the second meaning that's often used is, second word that's often used is shamatha. Shamatha means being calm. Being calm. So a concentration, meditation concentration is calm. It's still. So a combination of samadhi and shamatha gives us a sense of what we mean by concentration meditation. But concentration meditation is harder than learning to play soccer because we don't have the large muscles. My grandson had the large muscles. He had not only did he have his grandpa, he had all of the sensory material to work with. All we're sitting facing the wall. We don't have anything except our breathing, except our sensations. It's not that easy for us. But the potential is way deeper and broader than just learning to play soccer, because this is learning how to be with our own instrument and play our own instrument without getting caught by mandating and comparing and judging. So concentration, meditation, is the opposite of getting captured by each stimulus. So you're listening to me. Well, how long are you listening to me before you're listening to yourself? How long are you listening to yourself before, if you're sitting by the window there, you're hearing the birds or hearing the kids outside the window? How long are you listening to me before you're wondering how long this talk is going to go on? Right? My talk's going for a long time. You've got a lot of stuff you can wander around with, don't you? So just listening. just listening as much as possible. That's what concentration is. And we need to continually bring our attention back. Continually bring our attention back. Simple. Simple. Without judging, it's not hard. It's hard if we judge, but we just do it. Just total practice. We just do it.
Just do it.
So our spontaneous thoughts, they're coming in a mile a minute, listening to me, noticing the fan, remembering what we didn't do at home, wondering about the time, worried about the pain in my foot. Could I move when I'm sitting next to her? Or how will she feel? That's spontaneous. Thinking gets decreased, and there's a sense of calmness, So Japanese Zen is totally set up this way to enhance our concentration because there's meticulous attention to each detail of our movement. When we use the Oreo key, the nested eating bowls, until you get it down. But once you get it down, you can space out all you want. So it's better to never get it down. It's better to always... There's a detail, a prescription about how you do everything, and it fits together beautifully, and it's organically, but it helps your concentration. All the Japanese Zen exercises, except just sitting, have a lot of meticulous detail to help you come back. Because the mind is always finding something more interesting. The mind is always something. And I get tired of people telling me that only their mind is out of control. Only their mind is totally blah, blah, blah. Since everybody tells me this, what does that mean? What does that mean? You can tell me this, but I'm just going to say this is the human situation, you guys. This is what human beings do and what they are. So, in longer periods of sitting, sustained concentration is difficult. Even for some of you, for 20 minutes, it's difficult. It's difficult. One distraction and we're gone. But we just keep doing it. So one of the first books I read on Zen was Zen and the Art of Archery by Eugene Herigel. I wonder if we have that book in our library. We've got a lot of cool books in our library. Zen and the Art of Archery. So here's Eugene Herigel, German guy, practicing in Japan, what, in the 1940s or something? Something like that. Here he's writing. When you learn various things like stance, how to hold the bowl, where to place the attention, and so on, your mind lingers. So you find yourself all tangled up when you try to shoot. But if you practice day after day and month after month, eventually stance and shooting the arrow don't hang on your mind anymore. And you are like a beginner who knows nothing. I was thinking, oh, maybe Suzuki Roshi read this book before he gave his talk on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which gave so famous. But you know, I'm being facetious because he learned about this through doing it. The cogitating side of your brain will vanish, says Mr. Herigel, and you will come to rest in a state where there is no concern. Pretty simple. So over and over again, our intention to come back to this breath, to come back to this body, over and over again, until breath breathes. Breath is always breathing. Anyway, but till there's all breath breathing just is the main the main thing that's happening. It's possible for each one of us. So in concentration meditation, most Buddhist schools emphasize breath, not all of them. Breath. So why is breath emphasized so much? Well, there's a couple of things about breath that are kind of cool. One is that breath is always with us. So we don't have to bring in our sacred mantra, because here's breath, our sacred mantra. And it tethers us to our body. Breath is in our body, so it brings us back to our body. And our being in our body, being with our body, helps us just be present, just be open, just be kind. And also, with breath, we don't have to do anything active, like repeat something over and over again or visualize something. And whether it's shallow or deep, shows us something about how we're doing. Now, it's better not to evaluate it, just to open up your heart. But if your breathing is all up here, it means you haven't opened up your heart. So there's a possibility to soften your heart. And if your breathing is really deep, that's cool, but don't hang on to it. Don't hang on to it. Just let breath breathe. Now, if we were in working with a Japanese Rinzai teacher, he'd tell us, hara, hara, breathe. Breathe hara, Tim. Breathe hara. That's what Rinzai sessions teachers said to me. Breathe hara. Moo in hara. Moo. You don't mean. I won't get into this, but anyway, hara breathing, deep breathing in the belly. And you know, the Japanese Zen priests used to wear hara machis. They keep the hara warm. It's something you keep the hara warm, because you're getting out of your mind. You're coming back to your base, your center of your being, your hara machi. No, I think those things that I don't know, I don't remember, but we used to wind something around ourselves. Rosemary, what is that? Uh-huh. And I think that's like the haramachi, I'm not sure. Is it? I think so. Yeah, well, it's wound around the lower stomach to keep the belly warm so you can breathe it. So, if we're breathing in ahara, notice the pressure, notice the warmth, notice the coolness, notice the tingling. But don't get too fixated on your ahara, because then, you know, you won't be doing it well enough, and you'll try to sustain it, and you think you'll just get into all kinds of... Well, as a non-Rinzai teacher, that's what I'm saying. Do it, but don't make a big deal out of it. Or pay attention to your nose. Your nose is really good, because the nerve endings around your nose are really sensitive. If you notice your nose, just notice the breath coming into your nose and out. There's a lot of sensitivity and sensation here. A lot of sensitivity, a lot of sensation. Sometimes following all your breath, all your breathing. Breath goes all the way down. It doesn't go very far down. Just follow it and then let it go. Bring deep on the in-breath and calm on the out-breath. Or not so deep on the in-breath and not so calm on the out-breath. That's okay. It happens. It happens on its own. And, of course, then we can use many other kinds of concentration in meditation if you want to. You can repeat something to yourself. You can repeat a mantra. You can repeat your own words of encouragement. You can use some of Thich Nhat Hanh's gathas. He's got wonderful gathas that you can do with your breathing. You can do all that stuff. You could do visualization too. Now, I don't know anything about that. I've never done that. The only visualization I've ever done is like in retreats, especially in the old days, like about the fifth day. All kinds of visual stuff was coming up. It was like I was in a psychedelic circus. I don't know. I don't think that's what they're talking about. But it was kind of interesting. So, I've said many times, Alfred Lord Tennyson, in Britain, the time of Tennyson left, there was no instructions on meditation. So he began repeating his own name when he sat down. So he just repeated his own name over and over again. he got really still. And he had a breakthrough experience just by repeating his own name. Right? So you have we have all these ways to help us. All these ways to help us. So now we've done our concentration meditation for a while, and we're ready to do bare awareness. We've made our mind quiet enough through our concentration meditation that we don't have to have this narrow focus anymore. We can let it open up. We can let it broaden out beyond just the breath, to the body, to the sights and sounds around us, to our sensations, to everything. Bare awareness meditation. We're observing in bare awareness meditation our processes of thought, feeling, sensation, desire. We're just observing them. Bare, no comment, just observing them. We're paying attention to everything and anything that's happening. Just sitting facing the wall, paying attention to everything and anything that's happening. Instead of bringing the mind back to the breath, we're returning to just this, to just this. And in bare awareness meditation, emotional memories will be coming up sometimes. Don't look for them. They'll just come up when they feel like it. Sometimes they won't come up at all. Because within our storehouse consciousness, as I was talking about last time, there's all these emotional memories from the past. There's hundreds of seeds, to use the Yogacara terms, hundreds of seeds of past experiences that have coagulated into emotional memories that we carry in our unconscious, in what's called our storehouse consciousness. So some of that stuff's going to come up when we do bare awareness meditation. If it doesn't, something really weird is going on. It's going to come up. It's going to come up. And sometimes harmful, negative memories come up. Sometimes positive ones come up. And these seeds exert influence on our thoughts and our emotion and behavior. And we continually project through these seeds, and when we're sitting quietly just facing the wall, those projections just come out. They just come out. Not always. And somebody said to me, oh, I don't have any emotional stuff coming up in my meditation. I think I'm not advanced. Oh, come on. I'm not. You can be perfectly advanced and not have emotion come up just by being here. What's advanced? Get rid of this idea of advance. This is about being. About being. So, but too often, too much of our lives, we are a reaction machine. We are reacting based on the sprouting of all these seeds. The way you waved your head, raised your head, evoke some seeds. The way you looked at me evoked some other seeds. And so we are a reaction machine. We're always reacting based on the past. So we forget this wonderful stillness. We forget it. It happens to all of us, everybody. And it happens to you after you've been practicing for 40 years. 50 years, it still happens. So you don't get rid of it. But you learn to open up to it and to just be with it, and then to let it go before the little sprout turns into a big plant which takes over everything. If you just are kind to the sprout, the seed just sort of dissipates, and the sprout doesn't turn into anything. It just dissipates on its own. So through bare awareness, we become less reactive on and off the cushion. We become on our own, on our own without trying, less reactive. Don't get thrown off so much by our emotions when they come up. Make wiser choices. And notice our triggers without getting all wigged out about our triggers. These emotional memories trigger stuff. They're triggering. They're firing a lot, triggering this, triggering that, triggering the other. So we begin to just notice them in our bare awareness. And when we notice them, open our heart, depotentiate them. we depotentiate them. And if you can't find your heart, put your hand here. You've got a heart. It's not just mindfulness. It's heart mindfulness, okay? It's heart mindfulness. So, after I'd been practicing for so many years, my wife said to me, she said to me this many times, something like, and you know, I'm just paraphrasing it, "I don't know why you're so stingy." Something like that. "I don't know why you're so stingy." And I thought, "I'm not stingy. You know, I'm just frugal." And, you know, I'm not going to get into our arguments about that. You guys have your own arguments. So I'm just frugal. But then one time in meditation, somehow that thought came up. Because in meditation, all these thoughts come up. They don't go away. Actually, they're more pronounced. So the thought of, you know, her saying I'm stingy came up. And my grumpiness about that came up. And then I had this distinct memory of my father saying to me, "Well, you know, if you don't go to law school, don't become a doctor, don't become at least a dentist, you'll regret this for the rest of your life. You like material things." So that seed was there in my storehouse consciousness for years. And I didn't even know it. But when I saw the seed, when I got showed to it, and I did it mentally, you know, I saw it, it quit sprouting. So I became less stingy. Ask my wife. And did I go to therapy? No. But I did this. I did this practice. Right? Well, I'm probably still kind of stingy sometimes because my dad's still in there probably. I mean, you know, this stuff never goes away entirely. But the seed doesn't dominate anymore. It doesn't get activated easily anymore. It even seems, when I see it coming up, I laugh. I mean, it is kind of funny, isn't it? Kind of hilarious, isn't it, that after 50 years, the seed is still coming up. You know what Zen is? Zen is Buddhism with humor. That's all Zen is. Zen is Buddhism with jokes, as Guy would say. That's all Zen is. So our emotions and our conditioning are so strong that we really can't change how we feel. You can go to a therapist for a long time, maybe change it a little bit, but not very much. But we can lighten our load of seeds. We can be so present that the seeds don't dominate, that they don't turn into huge, giant plants. And, of course, in difficult situations, it's hard to practice bare awareness. It's hard. And that's why we have concentration meditation. We should, if there's too much bare awareness, and something really painful comes up that we don't want to look at, then just come back to your concentration meditation. Just come back to your concentration. And even now, after all these years, often my mind is a little too busy. And I just do my concentration meditation for the whole time. So let's not think of concentration meditation as being inferior. Nothing's inferior. It's not. There's no inferior in this way of practice. There isn't anything inferior if we're trying, if we're opening our heart as best we can. So by practicing over and over on the cushion, we're building up this new muscle. Now, Logan must have been building up muscles so he could coordinate with that ball, because now I get tired after being with those boys for 5 minutes because they're just, you know, they're so well coordinated. They've built up their muscles. They've built up their coordination. We do this with our meditation too. It's a little more difficult because we don't have the signs of progress, and we don't have the body doing stuff. But we do it. We do it. And of course, there's a huge backlog for all of us of emotional memory. There's a huge backlog. And some of them we've forgotten. Some of them have been repressed. But we don't have to worry about them. We just practice. And when they come up, we just see them. We just open our heart. They fall away. It's pretty simple. And if they don't fall away, well, then we're just with them. And if they start irritating us, we come back to our concentration meditation or loving kindness meditation. If it's too raw, come back to concentration. If it's still too raw, do loving kindness meditation. There's all kinds of meditations. Don't think there's the one true way. The one true way is just you. Just you. That's the one true way. You listening to the beating of your heart. You listening to your breathing. You trying to be present with people who are suffering, including moi, including yourself, not leaving yourself out. So most of our lives, if we don't meditate, is nothing but the activation of emotional memories projected on the world. It's kind of sad. Most people live their lives mostly that way. Kind of sad. But bare awareness does the reprogramming. It reprograms. Tim doesn't have to reprogram. Tim wants to reprogram, but he can't do it. He just creates more seeds. Bare awareness does the reprogramming, and there's a letting go of territoriality. There's a letting go of self-centeredness. And there's happiness just in doing, just in being. And bare awareness can also, on its own, help integrate hidden parts of us. Hidden parts of us. When I'm writing, for example, if I'm writing with bare awareness, I'll become more aware of the feelings I'm having with regard to the words as they appear. And I can more deeply enjoy just writing. Just writing. So, and through this practice, this two wings of our practice, meditative practice, we can experience Nirvana. Now, nirvana is this really loaded word, right? But I'm talking about etymology of nirvana. Nirvana means two things. It means to cool by blowing and to blow out. So when Buddha said he'd attained nirvana, he said, I've learned how to cool down all this stuff by blowing, by breathing. And I've even blown out my getting caught by it, my getting entangled by it. I've blown it out. We can all do this. And of course it will come back. But nirvana is always here. We can always cool it by blowing. So I'm reading something from 10th century in China. A Zen master, Pao Che, was fanning himself. A monk came up and said, the nature of the wind is to be constant. There is no place it does not reach. Why use a fan? Pao Che answered, you only know the nature of the wind is to be constant. You haven't yet grasped the meaning of it reaching every place. The student says, what is the meaning of it reaching every place? The master fanned himself. The monk bowed deeply. So strengthening and deepening the ability to blow, the ability to breathe, the ability to be here. So 900 years after that, or 800 years after that, Zen Master Yokan in China wrote, my hand is tired of fanning, but where can I set it down? My hand is tired of fanning, but where can I set it down? I get tired of doing this meditation. It doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. Can I just quit meditating for the next month? I mean, I've been sitting here long enough. I've been sitting here with you guys for my whole adult life. Give me a break. Right? Give me a break. Where can I set it down? Sometimes I feel that the fanning's too hard. Then if I feel that way, I should look at how I'm making my effort. Our life is calling us to pick up the fan. The fan's right here. And to keep going, to keep going. And that's how we deepen and strengthen our connection to each other and to our deepest self. Okay? That's how we do it. If we push too hard or we're critical of our effort, it sets us back. Our hand gets tired of fitting. If we make too little effort, we don't progress. Then we need to take up the fan, but take it up gently. Open your heart up when you take it up. Don't turn it into some big project. It's just life. It's just life. Turtle practice, you guys. Turtle practice. So I want to end with T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot is one of my favorite guys. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. That's it. We'll just start here. Just come back to this. And you'll see how fresh it is. You'll see how fresh it is and how available everything is to embrace you. Okay. That's my talk. And I'd be glad to entertain comments or questions or whatever. Anybody? Yeah.
I really like it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My heart. I'm wondering about how one knows, or if you have any guidance for knowing when I sit, when I need to turn to concentration versus open.
Oh, well, I would say that if your mind is doing monkey-like gymnastics, then you should do concentration meditation. That anytime your mind is just ripping from one tree to another, trying a piece of fruit and throwing it away and then ripping, then you should do concentration meditation. The other thing is, if stuff is happening in your awareness that's so raw that it's shaking you, emotions are coming up, they're so raw, they're shaking you and they're making you, then come back to some gentle concentration, loving kindness meditation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, over in the corner. There are two of you, so either of you could go first.
Well, thank you for your comments, for your talk. This is more of a comment. Malcolm Gladwell did a book, and I forget the name of it, and he studied a lot of people that were experts in their field, pianists and all that. And he came with the decision of the awareness that people had to practice, like, I think it was 10,000 hours in a profession in order to be an expert. So I think of that in terms of meditation.
Thank you. Did you guys hear what he said? Did you guys hear him back there? Yes, I've given a lot of talks on the 10,000-hour rule.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I try to encourage people by telling them about the Beatles and about Michael Jordan, what a lousy basketball player Michael Jordan was. You know, he only made it on the junior varsity. Anyway, yeah. So that's good. Read Malcolm Gladwell's book if you get it.
The Outliers.
Pardon?
Outliers.
Oh, Outliers. Yeah, yes.
How far does one go in opening one's heart?
Pardon?
How far does one go in opening one's heart?
How far does one go in opening one's heart? What does that mean? What do you mean? How far does one go in opening one's heart?
I'm just going through this process right now where I'm trying to sell my house, and I'm trying to work out a way to dispose of the contents of that house, which are, I've had four children who have not actually lived in that house, but have memories of many of the items in the house.
Yes.
And one of them in particular has come back to me and said that my process, which was to do it my way, which was to basically itemize and try and get preferences of people for what they wanted and all that. But that was too controlling, and that basically there was a sense of there needing to be more of a community process about that, which I do identify with, because I'm very much into community practice. And the difficulties of that are paramount, because there are all four of them in different parts of the world. And what I keep verging on doing, and I'm actually, I think, committed to, is allowing my child's needs to be paramount in that process. In other words, he wants to be able to go through all the items in the house and say, yeah, this piece, this piece, this piece. But for me, there's a point at which it feels like he's just sort of collecting stuff. You know, there's places for some of it to go, but the one thing I have really understood in terms of the seed underlying all this is my fear of getting stuck with a house full of goods when I'm supposed to move out.
Uh-huh. Could you guys hear her? People in the back row couldn't, and I'm not going to repeat it. But I could summarize it by saying her dilemma is that she has four kids who've left home, and she wants to kind of dispose of a lot of personal things, and they basically don't want her to because they love them all. Is that a good enough?
Yeah, they feel they have a right to.
They feel it as much theirs as they are hers. Well, this is complicated, but the first thing I want to say is that opening up your heart includes you. It includes your needs, your desires. This is your house. It includes them and you both. But you can't leave yourself out. That's my immediate reaction.
But in doing so, I could create great harm.
Well,
you can
do a lot of monkey mind activity about this,
yeah.
But that monkey mind activity isn't going to help. As much as possible, in a somewhat meditative way, you have to find what feels best for you and your kids. But you are first. They're your kids, so you should kick them out. You know what their needs are, and you know what your needs are. So there's no answer. The answer is
there is no answer. That's why I asked the question.
But there is a way to do this. There is a way to do this so that they will feel loved, and you won't feel put upon. And I don't know that way because I'm not you and your kids. There is a way to do that. There is. That's all I have to say. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'd like to respond to that.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
What comes up for me is by taking care of yourself, by taking care of yourself, you will be better equipped to take care of others. And that's just what came up for me. I also had another comment, but that's what I wanted to say to you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. Thank you.
The other comment I had is what came up from your speech.
Mm-hmm.
For me was that I played music for many years, and I knew I was playing my best when I wasn't thinking about it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I think we don't have any more time, Raymond. So thank you, and turn it over to Raymond.